Hello, and welcome to the Giants Double Play Podcast. I'm Henry Schulman, the Giants beat reporter for the Chronicle, and on Sunday I had the sad duty to report that Peter McGowan, the longtime Safeway chairman and managing general partner of the Giants, had died in his San Francisco home at 76 after a long series of illnesses. Although Peter left a legacy that goes far beyond that little ballpark at China Basin, he will long be remembered in San Francisco for helping save the Giants for the city in 1992 and building what is now called Oracle Park. We'll talk about that legacy after this. Welcome back to the Giants Double Play Podcast. I'm Henry Schulman, the Giants beat reporter for the Chronicle. We're talking about Peter McGowan's passing today, and I've asked my producer, King Kaufman, to join me. King is a longtime sports writer as well, and he's a Giants fan too. So, you know, he has some thoughts as well about Peter. Welcome, King.
Thanks. Good to be here, although not for a good occasion.
Yeah. Well, we knew that he did not have much time left. It's not something that he and the family wanted to put out publicly. Actually, Peter, through the years, didn't really reveal how sick he really was. But I mean, those of us who saw him in September at one of the last Giants games of the season, you know, we could see from looking at him and hear from what he was telling us that he knew that the end was probably coming. He had had so much that had happened to him. He actually told me, "I'll see you at spring training," as he walked away from me. And he kind of gave me a look that said, well, you know, probably not. And it did worsen over the years. And he died in hospice care Sunday afternoon, with his family around him. And he left a legacy that will go far beyond the ballpark and what he did in baseball, what he did for the city of San Francisco.
Yeah, we Giants fans, I think of him as the guy who saved the Giants from moving to Florida, which maybe not entirely true, although it's a fair way to think of him. But he had a whole career before that.
Yeah, I mean, he was the chairman of Safeway. He had sort of inherited that job from his father, although Peter did start in the organization doing some lowly jobs. He wasn't just handed the keys to the executive boardroom and executive washroom. He already was established as a business leader in the Bay Area when the Giants owner at the time, Bob Lurie, had not only threatened to move the team, but actually sold the team to a group in St. Petersburg. Now, it's not completely accurate to say that Peter just swooped in and saved the team. I mean, the league, other owners really didn't want the Giants to move, and they were looking for any other alternative. They did not approve the sale to Tampa Bay Group, but they said, look, you know, you, Mr. Lurie, you need to find some investors. I mean, you have a short amount of time to do it. And Peter and Larry Bear and some other civic and business leaders like Walter Shorenstein and Charles Schwab, Sue and Harmon Burns, and others, they got together and they put this group together, and very quickly were able to sell it to Major League Baseball and to Bob Lurie. And it is a little bit of shorthand to say that Peter McGowan saved the Giants, but he certainly had a huge hand in keeping the Giants in San Francisco and, of course, building the ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time that I saw him, which was at Candlestick Park. And he was he wasn't introduced, but he just walked around the ballpark there. And I remember it as being from late in 1992. And we were talking earlier, I think it was probably 1993, after he bought the team. But once the crowd realized he was there, this growing ovation, here was the guy who had saved the Giants for San Francisco. They were out the door. And the impact was immediate. I mean, 1993 was not exactly just another year for the Giants.
Oh, no. And, you know, in his first year, of course, the Giants won 103 games. They had missed the playoffs by one game. This was before they had the wild card. And you have to go back, actually, even before the season started, the McGowan Group, as it became known, had bought the team, but still had to be approved by the other owners, which was going to happen at the winter meetings in Louisville in December of 1992. And Peter had already decided that he wanted Barry Bonds. He wanted to sign Barry Bonds and bring Barry home to the Bay Area, not just you know, to improve the team, but, you know, make a big move right at the beginning of his ownership group to try and generate interest in a team that had been downtrodden for a while, at least attendance wise, and for a few years on the field. And he made it happen. I mean, at the time, he and the other owners agreed to give Bonds what was then a record contract, which is kind of laughable now, 6 years at $43 million. But he made that agreement and was about to announce it before the other owners had actually approved the McGowan Group as the new ownership group. So one of the first things that McGowan did as the managing general partner of this organization was tick off all the other owners. And, you know, it wasn't a great start, but of course, they got it done. They were approved. They had the press conference. Barry Bonds came back to San Francisco. And of course, the history of this franchise over the next 15 years and really even beyond could not be, you know, sort of separated from what happened at that very first winter meetings.
Yeah, and let's back up a little bit, because before that, before 1993, and you talked about Bob Lurie wanting to sell the team and the group was going to move it to Florida, the received wisdom, the consensus at the time was, hey, San Francisco is just not a baseball town. There's no way the Giants can survive here. And obviously, McGowan and his group proved them extremely wrong. It wasn't very long after that that San Francisco's the model baseball town. What did he see?
Well, I mean, I think he saw what we all have come to learn, that it's not just the city, it's also the ballpark. Remember, 1992 was still the era of these cookie-cutter stadiums. The stadiums themselves were not destinations, and that sort of changed when the Orioles built Camden Yards, and that was the first retro ballpark, which incidentally, the White Sox were actually given those plans and offered them. And they said, no, we'll build a more utilitarian stadium. And I think that that was a mistake, obviously. But once, you know, I think what they foresaw was that if you created a great destination that was not just hit by the fog and the weather so much and put a good team on the field, there was no reason you couldn't draw 3 million fans like the Dodgers did. The Dodgers having a good team in a great stadium in a great location. And I think that was the foresight. And, you know, one of the conditions for the McGowan Group getting the team and the other owners agreeing to this sale and keeping the team in San Francisco was that they do everything they can, the group, to create a new stadium. And, you know, the Giants, if you recall, had four failed attempts to get public financing for a stadium. One of them was an election that was 3 weeks after the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. And that measure was going to pass. It had the support once the earthquake happened. I think people sort of forgot about it. There were other priorities. There was like one of the lowest turnout elections in San Francisco, and it failed. And the Giants had to come to the realization that they were going to have to build a private financed ballpark. The city was not going to help them. And that was definitely not the way business was done at the time.
Yeah, it sure wasn't. I think Dodger Stadium that you mentioned had been the previous privately financed stadium. And there'd been a couple of generations of stadiums built since then. And McGowan and his group being able to get that done, a privately financed stadium, it was just unthinkable at the time. And that might be the thing that he's most remembered for.
Oh, absolutely. It required not just money, but it required a lot of forethought and thinking out of the box in terms of how to build a stadium. Because, you know, basically they had a $350 million stadium plan and they had to come up with the money themselves. And they did have some wealthy owners, but, you know, wealthy owners don't just sink their money into things like that. And that $350 million was still a huge chunk at the time. You don't think of it that way because the stadium and the team are worth well over $2 billion now. But in 1995, 1996, when they were formulating the plans for AT&T Park, that was a lot of money. So they came up with this plan where they would put some of their own money in. They would go get bank loans that would be secured by the future revenue, not only of the stadium, but of the sort of surrounding area out that would be created around the stadium with, you know, some of the Giants owners having some of that in terms of real estate and development. And then they also sold personal seat licenses, and they also got, I think they called them charter seats with the Giants. They got people to agree in advance to buy season tickets, and lo and behold, all of a sudden they had the money. Oh, and sponsorships. I mean, you know, the $50 million that Pacific Bell, which it was called at the time, that, I mean, without which the stadium probably couldn't have been built. Pacific Bell forwarded $23 million of that $50 million to the construction costs. And they created this sort of blueprint for privately financed stadiums. And now if this is why his legacy goes even beyond San Francisco, McGowan's, if you live in a city where you go to a ballpark, a stadium, a hockey rink, a cycling peloton that is 100% privately financed, you can thank Peter McGowan for and his group for creating that formula. And conversely, if you live in a city where you're trying to get a stadium built and you desperately need some public funds, Oakland, and you can't do it without the public, can't do it completely privately, then you might curse Peter McGowan's name.
And Peter McGowan's name, on the day someone dies or the day after someone dies, we all say nice things about him. But in a more full picture, it's not all positive news, right?
No, I mean, you can go all the way back to Safeway, and there was a lot of pain during his final years as chairman of Safeway as the company launched a leveraged buyout to take the company private, and they had to close stores and lay people off to make it financially acceptable. I think that's on the business side is one of the negatives that Peter might have been remembered for. And of course, on the baseball side, you can't sort of disengage Peter McGowan, this team, these executives from the steroid scandal. And Balco and the entire steroid scandal that kind of roiled the game in the early part of the century, it began with Barry Bonds and the Giants. It all started with an IRS investigation into Balco and some of the movement of illegally moved performance enhancing drugs. It led to Barry Bonds. It led to Balco, and the Giants profited very heavily from Barry Bonds' years with the Giants. One of the negatives that people said about ownership at the time, and now we're talking about after the 2002 World Series and the 2003 season when they won, they won the West, is there were 4 years there where they really weren't putting a lot of money into the team to try and win, but they, because they understood that they could make money on the Bonds hunt. And all this happened with the context of steroid scandal in the background. And then the Congress ordered a Mitchell report on steroid use in baseball. And, the Mitchell report was flawed because there were, it was very narrow in its focus. It picked on certain teams and owners and executives and players, ignored others. But Peter McGowan and Brian Sabian and the Giants took a lot of heat in the Mitchell report, and it was a black eye for the organization. And interestingly, in an interview with R. John Shea a couple of years ago, Peter acknowledged that he probably should have done more to maybe keep his eyes open to what was going on and understand more what was going on and maybe do more to try and stop it. But it didn't happen, and that will be part of the Peter McGowan legacy. One black mark in really a legacy that has so many bright spots to be considered.
The Giants won 3 World Series, of course, as Giants fans remember very well, 2010, 12, and 14. He's no longer at the top of the org chart at that point. What happened there?
Well, I don't think the whole story on that 100% has been revealed. I think that a lot of different things happened, and it could be sort of an amalgam of all three. For one thing, there were rumors at the time that the league was trying to force him out because of the negative attention that Barry Bonds brought to the entire sport. Some of the owners wanted him out. That was never really proven out in any kind of, media or story or anything like that, any kind of confession. I think part of it was that in the wake of Barry Bonds' departure, the Giants under McGowan, his leader stewardship, they gave out some really bad contracts, some really expensive contracts at the time. And McGowan was one who believed that, the Giants should have a face of the franchise. And Barry Bonds was the face of the franchise for 15 seasons. And knowing that that was coming to an end, he felt that Barry Zito would be a great candidate as the next face of the franchise. And they ended up getting getting him what turned out to be a very bad contract for the Giants. It was 7 years and $126 million. They had given Aaron Rowan $60 million over 5 years. So there was also some thought that the owners wanted to change, you know, because of the fiscal situation with some of those contracts not working out. And but the third part, which I actually know for a fact because Peter told me and I believe him, is that he was 66 years old in 2008. And he had spent his whole working life traveling from here to there and running corporations and this and that. And he said he wanted to spend more time with his family. He had grandchildren at the time. He was approaching 70 years old. And, you know, he when he died, he had 12 grandchildren. And I really do believe that he wanted to enjoy life for a while. So I think it could be part of all three.
He was still around, though. He was in the clubhouse in 2010. And you've told that story about your conversation with him there.
Yeah, you know, he always maintained until the day he died. Peter McGowan maintained an ownership stake. It was a small ownership stake. He never really had the biggest stake in the team. He always had one of the smaller investments, but you know, he was the voice of the team as well, and he maintained an investment throughout his living years. And I just remember, I can't forget the scene in 2010. Brian Wilson had struck out Nelson Cruz and the Giants had won their first World Series since the team moved to San Francisco. And I was in the clubhouse. He was drenched in champagne and a lot of us were interviewing him. And I asked Peter, does this right now, does this feeling right now, this title erase everything that happened before it, all the bad, the 1962 World Series when Willie McCovey lined out to Bobby Richardson to end Game 7 when a base hit would have won the series. In 2002, the heartbreak of losing a World Series when they were a couple of innings away from winning the title and it fell from their grasp. And I didn't really know how he was going to answer it. You know, I thought it could have gone either way. And without skipping a beat, he said, yes, absolutely yes. This makes up for everything because, you know, we have won it. We've done it for the city of San Francisco. And, you know, all of that stuff is in the background now. Now, you know, as I mentioned, you are a Giants fan, King, you know, long before the title, and you've been a Giants fan for a long time. I don't know how you feel about that 2002 thing.
Well, I felt in 2010 the same way that he did. You know, this makes up for everything. 2002 is gone, but that feeling does kind of wear off. And now, once again, when I think of Dusty Baker handing the ball to Russ Ortiz on the mound, it still is just as painful as it was in November of 2002. But I get the sentiment.
Yeah. And, you know, I get it too, because you know, every time I joke about, make some sort of crack or reference to 2002 on social media, I always get 10,000 people who immediately tweet back and say too soon. So, you know, and you know at different people have different at different times of their lives are more invested in baseball. And you know, I think there were some who were more invested in it in that era, the Dusty Baker era, than they ended up becoming in 2010. So I get it a little bit. But, you know, Peter was there for all of that. And, you know, I know that 2002 was a great disappointment for him as well.
Another innovation that he made, he brought in Barry Bonds. He got the ballpark built. He spearheaded that. Until there's a cure day, very common in Major League Baseball and around sports, days like it. That was the first one in 1994 at Candlestick Park.
Yeah, you know, and I think this is part of a legacy that, you know, most people won't remember about Peter McGowan, especially outside the Bay Area. But, I mean, you have to remember in the mid-1990s, 1994 it was, I believe, when the first Until There's a Cure Day happened, you know, AIDS was still a major topic because it was still in full bloom. It was still a crisis. And, you know, it had the stigma of being attached to the gay community, gay men in particular. And it wasn't something that was at the forefront of sports. Professional sports didn't want any piece of that. You know, nowadays, you actually have athletes who come out in various sports, and it's not as big a deal as it would have been 25 years ago. And Peter decided that he wanted to raise money for AIDS awareness and to find a cure, and he created Until There's a Cure Day, and it was an amazing event for 1994. They sold AIDS ribbons to raise money for AIDS research. And they had a ceremony before the game where activists and AIDS patients and whatnot formed a human AIDS ribbon. AIDS ribbon in center field at AT&T Park. It was just remarkable that in 1994, when you have these professional athletes who wouldn't even talk about stuff like this, they agreed, both teams, to come out en masse and join this human AIDS ribbon. And it did so much to push the issue into the forefront, and not just AIDS, but McGowan was the first, under his tenure, was the first to host an LGBTQ night. It wasn't called that then, but, you know, he was the first to host one. It was an outreach to a part of the community. It wasn't just a cynical way to tap into a market here in the Bay Area where there were a lot of gay people. It was something he felt was necessary because they were part of the community and the Giants were part of the community. And now I go to places like you wouldn't believe, like Atlanta in the Deep South. And I've been there with the Giants when they've had an LGBTQ night. And I think, wow, I mean, this is really amazing. And it's something that he set in motion. And I believe that until there's a cure day, still happens every year. They don't necessarily have the human AIDS ribbon the way they did it in the past, but it is one of his legacies.
Yeah, there were 50,007 people paid attendance that day in 1994, and you didn't get that kind of crowd very often at Candlestick Park in those days.
Actually, one of the odd things that happened, I remember that I think they were playing the Rockies that day, and they did this human AIDS ribbon, and both of the players were out there, and both of the teams were out there, and it was all this brotherness and togetherness. And then during the game, like one team hit one batter, the other team retaliated, and they ended up having a full on brawl out on the field.
Yes, file under Life is Complicated.
Yeah.
Well, life is complicated, and Peter McGowan, we've talked about the good and the bad. What do you think when we talk about him in 20 or 30 or 50 years? How will he be remembered?
Well, I think on the surface he's going to be remembered, obviously, for the two big achievements of helping to keep the Giants in San Francisco by helping to form that investor group, which was an all-star group of Bay Area businessmen, and then of constructing AT&T Park. And saving baseball for San Francisco forever. But I think he will be remembered and should be remembered as well for, you know, really being intertwined with the city and the ballpark. He was a guy who loved San Francisco. San Francisco was in his blood, even though he was not a San Francisco. He was a native New Yorker who ended up moving out here. It was part of his blood, as was his love for the Giants. It's something that started when he was 9 years old, and he watched Bobby Thompson's shot heard round the world on television, I believe. It was televised. And he went to the World Series game against the Yankees the next day in New York, and never lost his love for the Giants. And that really shone through the years that he ran the Giants and in the years afterwards. And he was not just some carpetbagging owner who came in here trying to make a lot of money for himself and all of his fellow investors. Although, I mean, he did that successfully, completely successfully, him and his successors. But, I think that if we could speak to him one more time, he would say, yes, that was all well and good. We all became financially richer because of the Giants. But those of us who have San Francisco in our blood and who have the Giants in our blood have this ballpark and this legacy that was created and will endure for many, many years and many decades to come. And with that, King, I want to thank you for joining me in this Giants Double Play podcast. I will be recording another Double Play podcast next week. Actually, it'll be a joint Giants Double Play and A's Plus podcast, where A's writer Susan Slusser and I will preview the 2019 season just ahead of spring training. We're going to talk about the five key questions for each team heading into spring training. Watch for that next week. And also, for those who bought tickets to the baseball talk that Susan and I are doing in San Francisco next week, an event that is sold out, unfortunately. Thank you for purchasing the tickets, and we look forward to talking to you then.
Giants Double Play is part of the San Francisco Chronicle Podcast Network. Audrey Cooper is the editor-in-chief. If you like this show, we'd love it if you'd subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a minute to give us a quick review, that helps us build our audience so we can keep growing. Follow me on Twitter, at Hank Shulman. You can support Giants Double Play and a lot of great journalism with a subscription to the San Francisco Chronicle. There are print and digital editions. Find out more at sfchronicle.com/subscribe.